this is, I must confess, I'm really excited about this event for obvious reasons. Anyway, Professor Stolovitz and Judge Posner, I don't think need much of an introduction around here. But I will introduce David Latt, and also I want to tell a little story. David now writes Above the Law, which I think most of you are familiar with, and if you're not, you know, you probably should be. But the background is he used to do a blog called Underneath the Robes, which was really great, and it was anonymous, no one knew who the author was, but it was written from the perspective, like, almost hard to explain, but of a woman who was, you know, really into the judiciary. There was great speculation as to who the actual author was, and Judge Posner was the first person to figure out that it was actually being written by a man rather than a woman. And so on that note, I will turn things over to
So I was, David and I were law school classmates, from the class of 99 at Yale, as was Allison LaCroix, who's on our faculty as well. I like to say that I knew David before he was a lady. David and I clerked on the same court at the same time, and notwithstanding a running commentary throughout our clerkship about the various idiosyncrasies of judges, I was completely shocked when David was disrobed as Article 3 Groupian. It made perfect sense in retrospect, but at the time I just had blinders on, admiring and being somewhat horrified by this Article 3 Groupie. And then I remember sending you a congratulatory email when you were unmasked in the New Yorker. So I think the topic that we've billed this discussion as being about is judges' private lives. It's a somewhat strange panel in terms of a privacy topic, in that I tend to think of myself as a privacy moderate. Dick is often a privacy critic, and I think David is the antithesis of privacy. So I'll try and do my best to maybe moderate some of my moderate tendencies, and to the extent that I don't think Dick and Dave are arguing enough, I'll see if I can lob a few bombs. I guess I just want to open up with a broad question, which is, Congress is a branch where I think if people run for Congress, they have diminished expectations of privacy. They expect to be celebrities in their district, celebrities in Washington, D.C., and have a lot of eyes focused on them throughout their affairs. Certainly that's true for the president and for high-level executive officers. So shouldn't there be one branch, the judiciary, where people can serve, good people can serve, and still live some semblance of a private, ordinary life?
Well, I want to answer a different question.
He's the judge. So.
How I unmasked Article 3 Groupie. So I really liked Underneath Their Robes. I thought it was not only very well done, but I thought it was quite valuable for students interested in clerkships. That had a lot of good information. And it was amusing beyond that. There were lapses. When Article 3 Groupie allowed Alex Kaczynski to nominate himself as the handsomest male federal judge, that was shocking. And then when he won, I don't know if any of you have met Judge Kaczynski, but at the risk of being offensive, he's a short, plump creature, and he's really quite unprepossessing. So, but I did begin to suspect that Article 3 Groupie was a male, and I had two reasons which were related. The first was the hyper-feminine style. I don't know if any of you, I guess it's been down for a while, so I don't know if any of you have actually seen it, but the hyper-feminine style struck me as false, because I don't think that's how young professional women talk. And the connected reason was, well, presumably the author, if you, was a junior lawyer of some sort practicing law. I assumed a private practitioner rather than a prosecutor. But this person would not like his employer or her employer to find out what was going on, because although I don't think any judges were offended by underneath their robes, I could see how lawyers would think that judges might be offended and therefore would not like it known that an associate of theirs in their firm. So what better way to conceal who you were by changing your sex? So I wrote Article 3. I emailed Article 3 groupie. We had some correspondence. I think you'd interviewed me or something by email. And I said, you know, I'm skeptical that you're one. Article 3 groupie replied that she would prove that she was one. And that she invited me to dinner at the French Laundry, you know, is a famous restaurant north of San Francisco. And I was kind of tempted, but I thought, you know, first, I'm married, I date other women. But the other thing was, What would be, if Article 3 groupie was a man, what would be easier than just ask a woman to impersonate him? So how would I say, you know, the name? How could I unmask someone who purported to be Article 3 groupie and was a woman? So I was thinking, well, could I ask her, you know, subtle questions about the technology of blogging or something like that? But she could easily be, if she was a lawyer, she could easily be briefed. So I declined the invitation. What would you have, oh, but yes, what would you have done?
That is a good question. I hadn't really quite contemplated that. I had all these sort of screwball comedy type ideas of, well, could I get a woman I was close to? Because I didn't tell anyone about it, not even my, you know, not friends or family. It was like, oh, could I confess a secret to one female friend I was close to, or my sister or somebody, and have her impersonate, you know, like with a little earpiece, or, you know, but it just kind of got a little bit ridiculous. But that's right. I had this flirtatious banter with Judge Posner. Judges too. He was not my only judicial suitor. But I think the exact words when he expressed doubt in an interview with the ABA Journal, he expressed doubt that the author of this blog, which is still up, it's pink and green and very cute. You can still Google it. It's the archives are all there. He expressed doubt to the ABA Journal that I was really a woman. And I think in a blog post, I said I would present him. The exact words were, with irrefutable proof of my feminine identity. Alas, no such proof is forthcoming. One fellow blogger, this fellow Chris Geidner, who used to write a blog called Law Dork, I think he described Underneath Their Robes and the character of Article 3 groupie very well when he said that I was essentially a drag queen of the legal blogosphere. Because it was like that. When Judge Posner was talking to the ABA Journal, he noted the femininity was so exaggerated. It was, in very many ways, it partook of the performative quality of a drag performance, that it was so over the top and so exaggerated. But on the other hand, I think I could have passed a lot of his tests. I know a fair amount about women's fashion. My tastes in television are, you know, they coincide much more closely with those of my female friends than my male friends. I really do feel very in touch with my feminine side. So I think I could have, if I could have found a female impersonator, I could have pulled this off. Oh, the question. I think it's a very fair question. And, of course, you do worry that there might be certain people who would be excellent at discharging judicial duties, but might be, you know, concerned about the light that would be shined upon their private lives. But I think that if you're going to have a life-tenured position exercising the judicial power of the United States, it is very hard to get rid of you. At least the political branches are accountable. I think it's only fair certainly we can poke around a little bit and kick the tires and see whether or not you might have a severe alcohol problem, or you might have trust issues, or you might have some kind of problem that might go to your integrity or your honesty. I don't blog quite as much about judges in my current blog, but I have this feature called Judge of the Day, and it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek because usually the people who win this prize tend to be dissolute or people who have been found guilty of judicial misconduct or alcoholic or sex offenders or all kinds of other horrible things. Most of them, one of the Article 3 groupies' little shticks was she was kind of a snob, and she said state judges were icky compared to their federal counterparts. And 95% of the judges of the day, I have to say, are state rather than federal, with all due respect to the many fine judges who do serve on the state bench. But I think that if you're going to be giving someone this kind of power, I think it's only fair to investigate them. And of course, you always hear about people who might have things that are sort of embarrassing but probably wouldn't go to their actual judicial duties, and they decide, oh, I don't want to go there because I don't want people to know this embarrassing thing about me. That's quite possible. But I would suspect that, and you know, this room is sort of full of perhaps future federal judges. You types of people are the types of people who would probably not have many skeletons in your closet to begin with. I feel like there are not many people who have these sketchy private lives and who also aspire to a life-tenured position on the federal bench. So I don't really know how many people are actually going to be chilled or deterred by this threat of some light from, you know, what, I don't even, and it's not even like this is TMZ.com or follow Judge Posner around with a handheld camera. I mean, you know, these are like blogs. These are like the ABA Journal or you know, the Wall Street Journal Law Blog or the Recorder or the Daily Journal. Or I mean, these are all like total inside baseball type publications. I mean, these are not Britney moments. So it's easy to exaggerate the extent to which judges are subjected to. But this is just my ramble. I mean, I'll let an actual judge speak to this issue.
Well, I agree with what David said. You want to distinguish between two types of investigation of judges. So one is the pre-appointment, the screening. And everyone accepts the legitimacy of that. It's quite elaborate, you know, FBI background investigation, and the Senate Judiciary Committee has an investigative staff, and the bar associations, and the media, of course, and the White House. So that screening is careful, and you know, anyone who wants to be a judge or, you know, accepts appointment understands you have to go through that screening. And probably, you know, some people are embarrassed by it and they decide to withdraw. But it's responsible in part, I think, the careful screening, for the fact that the incidence of, you know, corruption, criminality, and so on in the federal judiciary is low. But then, after the judge is appointed, you know, and this will include Professor Strahilovitz, but life tenure is a formula for abuse. There's no question about that. And it means that you're going to have misbehavior among federal judges. It's unlikely to, and it's been quite rare that it's reached the level of impeachable conduct. I mean, there are famous examples: Alcee Hastings, who was impeached and removed, and in the 70s, I think there were a couple of district judges who were convicted of tax offenses and removed, but it's extremely rare. And but that's not the sort of thing I'm talking about. But you know, why don't you give a person life tenure, and it's not just life tenure, but it's life tenure in a system where everybody of the same rank is paid the same amount, and you can't have bonuses, you can't have pay docked because you're lazy or something like that. And the ability to earn additional money outside of your judicial salary is very limited. So there really isn't, the carrots and sticks both have been largely removed. And it's left sort of to your conscience. So you may, you know, want to get a reputation as a as a good judge. But for many people, I'd say there isn't much perceived incentive to exert yourself. And, you know, they're little petty tyrannies. And so the insiders know that there are some, you know, misbehaving judges. It's not a high scandal, but probably it would benefit from exposure. Judges who fire law clerks at the drop of a hat. So I have a. Well, I don't want to. But I was told on good authority that a federal district judge fired a law clerk for splitting infinitives. And this judge was a fanatic about grammar. And actually, most grammarians now say, you know, it's not wrong to split an infinitive. Unless you split it, you know, with some gigantic, very long phrase in between the to and the verb. And there are other. I know one judge who the first 6 months of your clerkship is probationary. Now, of course, since it's employment at will, it's not clear exactly what it means to have the first 6 months. But after the first 6 months, the law clerk is invariably fired for having failed to satisfy the criteria for successful probation. So there is, there's stuff like that, and I don't see why that shouldn't be. So if the media discovered that, I don't think there'd be anything. Now the other thing that is disturbing about the judiciary is the code of omerta. Is that what the media calls it? So most judges swear their law clerks to secrecy forever. They must never discuss anything that went on. Now, that's very strange because these people, the law clerks, they're not the personal servants of the judges. They're, you know, civil servants, and presumably the only thing they should feel they aren't free to talk about is something where, on some neutral basis, you could say this is not the kind of information that should be public. So the obvious case is if a case is pending, it's just been argued, something like that, and it's pending, well, obviously you don't want to disclose how it's going to come out. So what I tell my law clerks is, you know, you mustn't talk about a pending case until it's decided. But after that, you know, you use your judgment. So I do tell them, if I say something nasty about another judge, living judge, I'd prefer you not repeat that. But other than that, I don't see any basis for the secrecy. The other thing that's questionable about the judges is the secret deliberations, right? So, you know, what the judges say in their conference after a case is argued is the media don't have access. There's no record is made of it. So that's odd. I mean, you'd want to keep it secret until the case was decided, or you might feel that it should be kept secret for some period of time. But it's odd that there isn't a record made of the deliberations, since it's obviously a public activity that would be archived in some way eventually. And the reason that these deliberations are secret, it's not that what the judges say in it is scandalous. It's that the public would be distressed by the kind of banality of the conference and the perfunctory characters of the discussion by the judges. So what it is, it's what sociologists, the professions, call mystique, right? So a profession is is an occupation where the members of which are trying to get the public to take them on faith, to trust them, because the lawyer and the doctor and so on can't really demonstrate exactly why what they're prescribing for you works, because you don't understand enough. So you have to take it on faith. And since you're asking people to take what you say on faith, you want to disguise any features of your activity which would make people skeptical and wonder why these people claim to have this expertise and why they telling you what to do. So I think the lawyers, and particularly the judges, have been very good at maintaining mystique and have done that in part by concealing their discussions of how they actually are going to decide a case. I say it's not scandalous, not that the judges that I know decide cases because they dislike a lawyer or dislike a client, but it's not very impressive. And so I think people realize the judges actually discuss these things a lot like an ordinary person would discuss them. They would lose an exaggerated respect for the judicial process.
What about the? So I think everyone on this panel at least would agree that things like law clerk firing ought to be publicized, because after all, judges are employers, and students who are applying for clerkships have a right to know. I think to the extent that there's personal behavior that suggests hypocrisy between, let's say, the judge's written opinions and the judge's own code of conduct, then that seems like fair game. But I guess I'm interested in exploring some of the closer to the line cases that sometimes get talked about in Above the Law. So David and I have talked about one of the more controversial postings on his blog, which involved Judge Marsha Berzon on the Ninth Circuit and the alleged shenanigans of her children on a plane flight. So I'll let David describe the incident in more detail, since he received the report from a correspondent. Particularly where we're dealing with judges' families, say, or conduct that's merely, so assuming the account that was on your blog is correct, the judge was, I think, inconsiderate, but certainly there was nothing unlawful. And the judge's minor child maybe didn't own up to a bad deed, but there was certainly nothing suggesting that she was a delinquent, and probably she suffered great embarrassment as a result of the posting. What's the social interest in publishing those sorts of accounts?
Well, yeah, it's true that it was not exactly a high crime or misdemeanor, but what happened was, so Judge Marsha Berzon is this very well-regarded judge on the Ninth Circuit, former Supreme Court clerk. I kind of have this strange obsession with her because, well, Lior and I, we both clerked on the Ninth Circuit, and I feel like a lot of my sort of warped vision of the federal judiciary actually has its roots in the Ninth Circuit, because it is a much more personality-driven court than a lot of the others, and in fact, if any of you are applying for clerkships, I would totally recommend applying to the Ninth Circuit, because it is fabulous. Because these judges, some of them are just these out, you know, like, in some ways, you have, you know, they're these larger-than-life personalities, and they have all these peccadilloes, and they're all so odd and funny, and unlike many other circuits where, I'd actually be interested in hearing how the Seventh Circuit does it in terms of circulating opinions and whatnot, but with the Ninth Circuit, everything is done over email, and generally most judges give their clerks access to the chamber's email. So you'll see opinions as they go back and forth. You'll send things out yourself. But then you'll also hear the judges just randomly, you know, Judge so-and-so sends around an article from the New York Times. Isn't this interesting? And you just get to be this fly on the wall as these people who are making decisions that affect 9 Western states and millions of Americans are just rambling about whatever issues of the day they feel like talking about. And then sometimes they get really catty with each other, like when they're trying to decide whether or not to rehear things en banc, which happens a lot in the Ninth Circuit because they have this modified en banc process. And sometimes they'll get a little bit ad hominem, and it's kind of fun to watch these judges get snarky with each other. So Judge Berzon, I kind of had her built up as sort of this heiress to the mantle of liberal lion on the Ninth Circuit that Judge Stephen Reinhardt has held for so long. I called her she who must not be named, and other, I mean, this is the Federalist Society, right? So, you know, so I kind of had built her up in this very mysterious way. And so she was on this plane with her family, and she had her daughter, who was putting a bag up in the overhead compartment, and she had this, her little latte, and the latte spilled all over this chair. Now, there was nobody in the chair at the time, but the minor Burzon just decided that she was just going to kind of go about her merry way, and
how old was she?
She's a teenager. And actually, I heard from a friend of hers that she was actually okay with this posting, because I didn't name her. You wouldn't be able to pick her out from a lineup or anything. And then somebody came along, it's better to read the post. I'm rambling a little bit, but if you go to the site and find it in the archive. But, okay, I'll be frank. This is not exactly one to have any bearing on her jurisprudence or anything, but some stories are just entertainment value. And if you read the story, it's one of those stories that's better in the written up form, because if I just sort of tell it to you off the cuff, which I just did, it doesn't sound as impressive, but I kind of built it up into this Homeric epic in the telling of it. And so it sounds better that way. So I think part of it is just that, because there is a human...
I've got the printout.
I could... That's hilarious. There's a certain entertainment value to it. And, you know, why do any of us gossip? Why do any of us sit around and shoot the breeze? I mean, one could argue, well, what if we were sort of take the hardcore Chicago law and econ analysis? Well, what value is produced by that? One could argue very little. But on the other hand, there's sort of like an entertainment externality here. I mean, you know, people just enjoy talking about this. So it may not necessarily shed light on her jurisprudence, but it's just kind of funny. And also, on the Burzon story also, there was a sort of aspect to it that some people thought it was mean-spirited. Judge Kaczynski kind of, you know, flagellated me a little bit for it. But I kind of thought of it as a good example of the whole judges are just like us point, which was sort of central to underneath their robes and also above the law. That, you know, when Judge Posner wakes up in the morning, he puts on those suit pants one leg at a time. And, you know, if you read this fascinating New Yorker profile of him by Lewis McFarquhar, I'd be actually curious if Judge Posner has any object. Like, if that was a... I've read that piece, like, so many times. It's just so fascinating. Like, his relationship with his cat. I mean, does that necessarily shed light on his jurisprudence? No, but I want to know about his cat. And I want to imagine this federal judge, like, cleaning the kitty litter box, which he says, which he claims, professes to do in this article. So, anyway, those are my ramblings. But I was curious about, like, whether anything was inaccurate in that article. But also, don't forget Lior's question. I've sidetracked us. I tend to be very discursive, in case you haven't noticed.
No, the article is very accurate. There are tiny mistakes, but the New Yorker has very elaborate fact-checking. And the fact-checker went over everything. It was quite accurate. And what's funny is, so that was 6 years ago. I still get strangers asking me, you know, how is Dinah? Just yesterday, someone said, and by the way, how is Dinah? And I thought it was a very good article. I thought it was great, very well written, and it was really accurate. But what I particularly liked about it was, you know, New Yorker has a circulation of 800,000, and, you know, probably more read it because it would be, you know, family would subscribe, wouldn't it? So maybe 1 million people. So 1 million people are flipping through the pages, and then they come across this picture, and here's my cat. And as far as I know, it's the first time a photograph of a cat has appeared in the New Yorker. So my cat, in my own mind, became a major animal celebrity. I'm sure very few people read the article, but they saw the cat. And in the immediate aftermath, I got these wonderful emails. So one person said, I almost got into trouble, because one person said, your cat looked really unhappy in that picture. I could see in her eyes that she didn't want to be held and photographed. And it was almost like she was going to report me to the ASD. ECA. And she was completely right, because our cat is morbidly shy. And she was really very unhappy. But I thought, actually, in the wake of it, that I would get some inquiries from pet food companies. They'd say, you know, we'd like, because Dinah's a very beautiful cat. They would say, you know, we'd really like Dinah to model our gourmet cat food. And then I would say, and then I had it all. I would say, well, you know, we're really flattered by your interest, but Dinah is shy, so I have to refuse, you know, the enormous income that would accrue to me. So, but anyway, I still get people inquiring about Dinah, so that was fun.
So, Judge, do you feel that you should have been included on the Judicial Super Hotties contest? Because there was, I did quote a reader who did say that Judge Posner, I think the exact words were, a tad bit sexy. Although I think, actually, it was a Chicago lawyer who said, my legal assistant, my paralegal, has a huge crush on Judge Posner. I'm not sure how much of it has to do with his looks, however, but this paralegal has this intellectual crush on you. So did you feel you were robbed by not being nominated?
Not until I saw Judge Kaczynski.
I mean, in fairness, first of all, Judge Kaczynski, when he was a younger man, there's a video clip of him up on the web of him on The Dating Game. Very good looking when he was younger. And there are even a few shirtless photos, too. You can see the hair on his chest, very masculine, ruggedly handsome. He's, the years, you know, he's gained, you know, it's only natural. You gain a little weight or your hair goes a little gray. But the other nominees were by, you know, I don't know how to say that, in politically correct, by conventional standards, were very good, you know, like Chief Justice Roberts. He was then Judge Roberts, you know, very handsome, strapping, all-American kind of guy. Jeff Sutton, quite a piece of judicial beefcake. I mean, like, these were legitimate. Most of these folks were. Justice Souter was on the list. Not my company. There's a Latin saying, there's no disputing taste. Souter, not my type, but a lot of people found him appealing.
Really? He's not obviously a comment on his judicial, you know, performance, but I've only met him once. But he struck me as very wise, right? He's very slight, and he doesn't have a happy look.
But I think the slightness was an appeal to one commenter, one reader, who said something like, he runs a lot, so they like the lean physique, and they said that they would grant certiorari to that hot, lean body. Jeff Sutton, but he does have this certain thing going for him. But I agree with you. He's a little bit, there is a wizened aspect to him. He didn't get my vote, but.
The people who write in and vote on these are a really weird bunch of them.
But, you know, this was, back in the day, right now for Above the Law, whenever I do a poll, there's polling software, which tends to be a little bit better than tracking the votes manually by email. People can vote. You can put up restrictions on IP addresses so only one IP address can vote, or you can allow people to only vote once during a 24-hour period. Back then, when Underneath the Robe started, I started the blog in 2004, which in, you know, the blogosphere age was, you know, like the Stone Age. Actually, Judge Posner started his blog that same year, I believe, in maybe November or December. In fact, he gave me the scoop. Oh, was it 2005? I got the scoop, though, in terms of breaking the news, because we were such blogosphere pals. I got to announce to the world the arrival of the Becker-Posner blog. But, so I'm digressing. So I would actually manually track all these votes by email. And it lent itself some shenanigans. One of Judge Kaczynski's sons, I think, voted for his dad like three times on like different email accounts. And also, I think Judge Kaczynski had sort of spammed a group of international judges. So I had these Supreme Court justices from Canada writing into me from their judicial.ca.gov, whatever address is. I vote for Alex Kaczynski. Alinsky as hottest federal judge. So I don't know if you want to take into account foreign law or not, but the votes of foreign jurists definitely swung the tide in Judge Kaczynski's favor. Whereas if I were to sort of do a second annual, it's not really annual, a second judicial hotties contest, and pretty much anyone could vote, and the readership of Above Law is much larger than UTR's was, even if in some ways UTR was kind of more elite and insider-ish, you would probably have winners who would be much more in line with conventional Brad Pitt, Orlando Bloom kind of ideals of male beauty. And female beauty, too. I don't want us to lose track, you know, like Judge Wardlaw, Ninth Circuit judge, very attractive. She was on the Judge Kimba Wood, former Playboy bunny. But not a playmate. Everyone always thinks she just worked as a hostess while she was at the London School of Economics for grad school, and she was making some extra money on the side as a hostess, and she did this. It was a very short-lived thing. I think she was there for a week as a trainee, as a bunny trainee, and decided that this was not the thing for, you know, a Harvard Law School gal like her. So she was out of there. But she forever became known as this. And then, of course, when the New York tabloids got wind of she was married to this writer for Time. This is all public, so I'm not bad-mouthing anyone. I mean, this is in the public record already. She was married to this writer for Time, Michael Kramer, but she was kind of having this romance. It wasn't clear what the contours of it were with Frank Richardson, this centimillionaire financier who is now her husband. And some of these some of their love letters got released to the public, and the tabloids had a field day and called her the love judge and unearthed this little tidbit that she had worked briefly in this Playboy club. But she was never a playmate, so people keep on thinking that they can find this spread of her. That's not happening. Unless there's something I don't know about. She never posed.
But you know, what David has exposed, something the Federal Society should be very alert to. Some of us are very concerned about the Supreme Court and other courts citing foreign decisions as authorities in American law, but having foreign judges actually voting on American judges, that's a good thing.
But I had there were no terms and conditions to the contest, so I think that the default...
They're so aggressive, foreign judges.
All different continents, come to think of it.
Well, trying to influence our evaluations of American judges.
In fairness, I think they were dragged into the moment of David's description. I guess I want to shift.
That's even worse. Right? I can imagine some of these liberal judges who use their, you know, computer spam equipment to fabricate votes of influential foreign judges decisions.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. Personalities and the attributes of the folks who are getting confirmed to the federal judiciary these days. So, you know, Dick was obviously colorful as an academic and as colorful as a judge, and I think that's certainly true of Frank Easterbrook, who's also on our faculty, Guido Calabresi, certainly a colorful figure. Have the recent appointments to the judiciary been as colorful, excellent, interesting, provocative as the Kaczynskis and the Posners and the Calabresis, or have executives become too risk-averse lately in appointing people who don't have paper trails and therefore won't get into trouble in confirmation hearings that seem to delve deeper and deeper into personal proclivities and paper trails?
Well, I think there is more ideological screening. Because until Reagan, the lower court appointments, district judges and court of appeals, were largely patronage appointments. So the rule was that the senior senator of the president's party would appoint federal judges from his state. And, you know, there were obviously other factors involved, but that was very, very important. And it took a while, I think, to realize, for the Democrats to realize that Reagan, I think this was Ed Meese was primary mover behind this, really wanted to alter the ideological profile of the federal courts, wanted to make them more liberal, particularly the courts of appeals. And I was the first professor who was nominated by Reagan in 1981. And the processing of my nomination and my hearing, my confirmation hearing, was completely perfunctory because no one knew what Reagan was doing. And when Senator Percy introduced, so at my confirmation hearing, there was one judge, I mean one senator, with only one senator was present, Strom Thurmond, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And it lasted about 5 minutes. And when I was introduced by Senator Percy had actually opposed my being appointed because, you know, he didn't know me, and he had his own candidates. And the White House worked out a deal with him that if he would go along with me, support me or not oppose me, they would give him the next vacancy, which in fact we did. So when Senator Percy introduced me to the committee, which is the custom, he's the senator from Illinois, he said, "Oh, Professor Posner has written enough books to hang anybody." And everybody laughed. So when I got into the hearing, there were a couple of other judges who were being confirmed at the same time. And notice the first question that Thurmond asked each of these nominees was, "Are there members of your family present whom you would like to introduce to the committee?" And they had, you know, a wife or a child or something. And when it came to my turn, he asked me the same question. I said no, because they hadn't told me that it was customary to bring your family with you. So he frowned. He said, "You do have a family, don't you?" I assured him, "Yes, I had a wife, I had two children, I had a dog and a cat. I was a real American." And then he asked a couple of questions. I don't think it even lasted 5 minutes. One of his questions was, "Do you believe that it's the responsibility for a judge do you agree that it's the responsibility of a judge to apply the law, but not to make the law?" And I said, "Well, that was true in general, but of course, you know, there are cases where it's very uncertain and the judge has to be creative." So fine, it all went. It was uneventful. I was confirmed. And then a few weeks later, the Senate Judiciary Committee sent me the little hearing that the GPO publishes. So it had, you know, the text of my hearing. And that question was there, but someone had changed the answer to yes. So the whole thing was, it actually left me with a somewhat sour feeling about the Senate. The other thing that was strange about the confirmation process was, when we were told the day of the hearing that, you know, the three judges that were involved should assemble at the Justice Department, and then we'd be carried to the Hill. And when we assembled at the Justice Department, we were told what questions we would be asked. So it was like, you know, cheating on an exam, the answers before the question. So the whole thing was, as I say, it was not a serious process. But as soon as it was realized that the administration was trying to appoint conservatives, the screening became much, much tighter. And so now, if the party in opposition wants to block someone, then if the person has been, you know, has published a lot or has been controversial in any way, that provides ammunition. So probably the appointees nowadays, on average, are somewhat blander than used to be the case.
I agree entirely with that. As someone who follows the judiciary, I'm a little bit disappointed in a way, because I feel like you don't have these super colorful figures that you had in the past. Because on the one hand, I think part of it is a consequence of both parties starting to pay more attention to the judiciary. I think before Meese and the Reagan Justice Department, it was it was largely ignored in some ways. And I don't think people realized the extent to which the courts, I mean, you know, of course you had the Warren Court, but I think that people, at least at the lower federal court level, especially on the circuit courts, I don't think people necessarily thought as much about the power of those courts to shape the law and to shape, and also to shape policy debates. And so I think that now that people sort of focus on it more, and if you're out for blood, you can totally look through somebody's paper trail, you end up with only, I think there are, if I haven't done any kind of statistical analysis, but I would bet you have fewer law professors, fewer people who've thought big thoughts. Lots of people with, it's becoming a little bit more like a European civil servant model to the judiciary. Lots of people getting promoted from sort of lower ranking judicial appointments where they can sort of show, okay, I can do the job of judging, but they don't do anything crazy. So you might have a lot of magistrate or bankruptcy judges or a lot of judges from state courts who then get moved over to the federal system. So you see a lot of that, but I feel in some ways that you'll see fewer people like Judge Posner, Judge Easterbrook. I mean, look at the appointments from the Reagan years. I mean, that's sort of an all-star of these people, these really big thinkers who are now very prominent judge, you know, like Justice Scalia and Judge Bork and all of these, and Easterbrook and Posner and all of these other giants of jurisprudence, and it will be hard to get some of these people through today. Take Judge McConnell on the Tenth Circuit, who he did get confirmed, but he had written a lot of writings that troubled people on the other side of the aisle, and so he had to get this sort of this love letter from like 100 liberal law professors who are like, okay, the guy's kind of conservative, but he's not a nut. And nowadays, if you want to get somebody like McConnell or a professor confirmed, you sort of have to go through all these hoops. And so, and also you end up with a lot of the parties trying to sort of suitor each other, like in terms of people who are like secretly, I know this person is liberal or I know this person is conservative, but ha ha ha, they don't have a paper trail, so let's send them up there. And what can be really frustrating is the other party is kind of like, just through sort of D.C., I live in D.C. now, like just through D.C. gossip circles, you know, like, oh, that person is totally conservative or liberal, but if you don't have the goods on them, what can you do? You saw it a little bit at the Supreme Court level where they knew that Roberts and Alito were going to be pretty solidly conservative, but they didn't quite have the goods on them, and so they tried to sort of use these other things as proxies, whether it's, you know, the concerned alumni of Princeton thing for Alito, or whether it was cases that Roberts had worked on in private practice. But it was really hard for them to sort of nail these folks. And I think also people adapt. So now if you're thinking, I mean, I would urge any of you who are interested in federal judicial office, be very careful about what you write. I mean, people can find everything. They can go back to your law school note. They can go back to, I used to write editorials for the college newspaper, and I was kind of the campus rabble-rouser. And now, those weren't online for a long time of part of my adult life. And then apparently the Crimson decided it would be a good idea to employ hordes of people in, I think, Bangladesh to sort of, no disrespect to Bangladesh, it was Bangladesh. They contracted with some company in Dhaka, and they just have now uploaded, you know, going back to the 1800s or something, everything from the Harvard Crimson. And there are little these like weird little typos and stuff. But now you can sort of see all these youthful indiscretions and all these crazy things I wrote. But it's all there now. So if you're thinking, I mean, be very careful. Here's a story from our law school days. There was a bachelor party for some person who got married in the Yale Law School class. And as soon as I was not present at this, but this is just something I heard through the great. Fine. And as soon as the entertainment showed up, two people who were sort of gunner types who were known to harbor aspirations for the federal bench promptly excused themselves. Like, nobody wants to be, were you at a bachelor party in 1999 where a dancer performed? Nobody wants to be that guy. And so I would just urge you all, you know, even just to be a federal prosecutor. I was in AUSA before, and at the time I was also doing Underneath the Robes, which is kind of another story in and of itself. But even just to be a federal prosecutor, they ask you about all this stuff about your drug use or your alcohol use, and it's very detailed. So think carefully before you decide to do anything that is, I mean, obviously you're lawyers, you shouldn't, you know, and there's character and fitness for the bar and whatnot, but sorry, I'm rambling again.
We should open things up for student questions. Fire away.
Perez Hilton has been accused of contributing to Britney's problems because he continuously exposed everything she does. And you seem to like colorful characters, but aren't you also contributing a problem by continuously exposing people's colorful behavior? And won't that chill people from continuing to be colorful and then also expect you to manage?
That is true. There is sort of like, it's a little bit like an environmental problem of like overfishing or something. Like for example, at Above the Law, I do a series on crazy summer associates. People who just do get drunk over the summer at the law firm and just do crazy things. But the problem is, nowadays, everybody knows that if they do something crazy as a summer associate, they're going to wind up on my website. In fact, there was a career counselor at another law school who said, who are parting words to the class were, I don't want to see any of you on AboveTheLaw.com. So there is this problem of these sort of this diminishing pool. But I have faith in humanity. I think that the human species is endlessly adaptable and entertaining, and I think that people will find ways to make fools of themselves in new and different ways. So I think that, and you know, granted, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I do tends to be on the lighter side. Of course, it's always a downer when you post some funny story and then somebody emails you and says, well, actually, that person has serious issues, and you know that, but I. In a bad way. I mean, my sister, she was bipolar. She committed suicide at age 24. Like, I'm not, you know, when people say, I'm not unsympathetic to these things. I mean, when I write about people with mental health issues, or when I write about law students or lawyers who are like scandal du jour, when I unmasked myself as a federal prosecutor who was writing this saucy blog in the guise of a woman, I was scandal du jour. I was on the Drudge Report. So, saucy blogger, a spicy blogger, a sassy blogger. You know, I was, and so when people tell me, oh, you don't understand what it's like to you know, to be the object of this scandal and attention, I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, I have been there, so it's not. I understand all of that. And the sites that I do, whether it's Above the Law or Underneath the Robes, I always offer them in a good-natured way. I'm not trying to be spiteful or anything, because, I mean, I have no particular axe to grind. I have no dog in this fight. There's a great quote by this conservative writer, Jeffrey Hart. He says, gossips do not want to change the world. They just want to enjoy it. And that's my philosophy. I have no... When I was younger, I kind of have more of an ideological agenda. I mean, New York, and I was like the go-to guy for the conservative viewpoint in class. I was vice president of the Federalist Society at Yale. Whenever Owen Fisk or somebody needed the conservative whipping boy, Mr. Latt, like, I would be that guy. But now I'm kind of less ideological. I'm more just like, what's funny and crazy and wacky? I mean...
over there. Yeah. Sitting down.
Me?
Yes.
I'm a huge fan of Above the Law, and I think you provide a great service to us law students and the lawyers. But I wonder what response you get from firms, and specifically, do you think that your blog and blogs like yours are changing the way law firms run their businesses?
I think so. Actually, I can have a substantive tie in here. I don't do too much substance, but a lot of Lior's work, actually, and his scholarship relate to using, sort of harnessing this information to sort of help people make informed decisions about their lives. And I feel in some ways, in terms of my treatment of law firms, that's what I'm doing. Or even at Underneath the Robes, when I would write about judges and clerkships. These are important decisions. You know, on the one hand, one cynic could say, oh, well, all firms are all alike. And there is some there's a certain grain of truth to that. But on the other hand, there are these legitimate differences, and I think my site does expose them so people can make informed decisions. And, you know, different firms are right for different people, and there's no one-size-fits-all, but I think that people should at least know what the factors are. So that's a lot of the point of the site, I think. And it definitely does, I think, change the way they do business. One thing that I've been focusing on lately is parental leave policies in terms of, well, how much leave will firms give you if you have a child or if you adopt a child? And the industry standard for a long time used to be 12 weeks. And then now a few firms upped it to 18 weeks. And once you post one memo, oh, look, Simpson Thatcher went to 18 weeks. Suddenly everybody does it. And they always go to the exact same. Very few people will like up the ante to like 20 weeks or something. But they'll all fall in line because nobody... The law is a very hierarchical profession in some ways, and it's very reputational. I mean, a lot of lawyer scholarship relates to reputation. And so no firm wants to be known as, oh, we're the laggard firm that only gives you, you know, like, whatever the bare minimum under the FMLA or whatever is. No firm wants to be that firm. I mean, as I was riding over in the cab here, sorry for the delay, it was snowing, and my cab driver was talking all about why she loves Huckabee, and... it was really interesting, actually, because I just thought that this was like Obama country. And she was saying, this is a direct quote, she's like, Hillary and Obama are communists. And she was kind of awesome, actually. And I'm sort of like an ideological chameleon, because as a gossip, I just want people to keep talking. So whether they're liberal or conservative, like I cover the FedSoc convention in November, I go to the ACS convention, and whoever I sidle up to next to the bar, I'm like their ideological soulmate. So I'm just like nodding, and oh yes, I'm a Christian too, and I am. But like, you know, very interesting to hear her views. But so as I was riding over in the cab, I was checking my BlackBerry, and this law firm PR person is like, you don't have our parental leave policy right. Actually, it's bifurcated, and we actually give more leave for this person. You know, so the firms are definitely cognizant of it. And I think it's generally for the good. Of course, there's a counterargument. One thing I also track is salaries, and so a lot of firms are trying to raise salaries and bonuses, and some people might argue, well, are firms overextending themselves? Are they paying associates too much? Is it not an economically feasible model for some firms? But the way I think of it is I'm just putting information out there. It's up to law firms to sort of say, okay, we're not a Cravath or a Wachtell. We can't afford to pay you $160 to start. You know, it's up to the firms to sort of manage themselves prudently. I'm just a guy with a blog. I mean, so I don't want to overemphasize whatever influence my blog or other blogs or other message boards or websites have. But I think it's generally for the good. But there are negative aspects to it, too. You just try to control them.
Nick.
Have you run into any issues with posting leaked memos about bonuses and salaries and all that? I mean, I assume someone is unhappy with a leak that went onto your website.
Sometimes, but you know, it's very funny. It's like a lot of times... Sometimes the firms just make it worse for themselves. If they have a meeting, like if this is an associates meeting, and the partner says, now, I don't see what benefit accrues to this firm from disclosing our private information, somebody will email me and they'll say, and by the way, the managing partner said, I don't see what benefit accrues to the firm from disclosing private information. So, and the firms have started to play ball with me, and sometimes they will actually send me stuff directly, like through their PR person or something. They often don't want their fingers on it because, you know, the blog is still kind of quasi-salacious and scandalous, so they don't want to be fully co-opted. It's not like I'm NALP or something, so they don't want to completely be in bed with me, but they know that I have a readership, and they will often sort of play ball. But there are controversies. I mean, the most sort of notorious one was involving this firm called Nixon Peabody, which had this theme song that they composed, which the chorus is something like, everyone's a winner at Nixon Peabody. And it was sort of, they won some award from Fortune magazine for being a best place to work. And they commissioned this song, and it was just completely ridiculous. And I made fun of it. And that would have been it. It would have been one funny post and an MP3 up on the site. But then they called me up and started threatening me with copyright infringement. I put part of it on YouTube. They sent a takedown notice to YouTube. And then suddenly, it's like Nixon. It's like the cover-up is worse than the crime. The New York Times picked it up. The headline was, Law Firm Objects to Unauthorized Enjoyment of Song. ABC News picked it up. If they had just ignored it, they would have been fine. But when they saber rattle, it just makes it worse. Because it also, the media loves to sort of take established narratives and just run with them, like Obama, young, fresh, exciting. You know, they love to like sort of take the pre-existing narrative and just advance it. So if law firms are regarded as stodgy and humorless, and then there's a firm being what? Stodgy and humorless, they'll totally go for that.
No, there's a general point that in late what David just said, if you're criticized publicly, you have to make the following judgment. If you have two choices. If you don't reply at all, the initial criticism will probably simply die for sort of lack of oxygen. So it'll be out there once, and it won't be repeated, and it will be completely forgotten because of the enormous volume of information. But if you reply, no matter how devastating your reply, there's a good chance that that is going to create material for a second story in which the first criticism, you know, is repeated. And so you don't want to feed oxygen to your critics. And it's usually more effective simply to ignore the criticism. And his example, Nixon Peabody, a very good example of that, how they dug a hole for themselves. Whereas, the initial posting, it's this stuff, there's so much of this stuff coming at you from the media that, you quickly forget about the...
No, it depends, of course, on the size of on the magnitude of the initial disclosure. So it wouldn't have been a good idea for John McCain to ignore the New York Times article from a day ago. He needed to say something about that. But, of course, it does feed the story. I think we have time for maybe one more question. Jason, back.
I wrote a post that you wrote this morning. It's kind of a question that I had today. It was about a judge in Louisiana. I forget her name. And I just sort of started Googling.
Yeah, Judge Alford.
Yeah, I just started Googling judges. And it seems that the vast majority of judges that have severe consequences for severe judicial misconduct are elected. And I was wondering if you had any insights into the reasons behind that. Because intuitively, you would think that with the life tenures you were discussing before, there would be less, or there would be more of an incentive for a higher degree of judicial misconduct, where an elected official would be continuously scrutinized every time the term completed. So I was wondering if either of you had any insight into the functioning of why that seems to be the case.
Well, I think that would be true if the screening were identical, one way in which you If you don't think you can control people's behavior directly, then you become very, very concerned with the selection. So, with the federal appointments, first of all, most of the people who are appointed are 40 in their 40s or 50s. So that means they have a long a career behind them, and by studying the career, you get a clue to their work ethic and their ethics and so on. So the hope is that if you screen carefully, you'll get people who, kind of their gyroscope has set them on a particular course. They won't deviate too much. On the other hand, if you do have electoral checks, short term, no tenure, then you can be more, you can take more risks with the selection. I suppose the problem with the elected judiciary is that the type of personal qualities that make you an effective politician may not align well with judicial behavior.
I completely concur with what Judge Posner said, and I think that the qualities are different. I often take U.S. attorneys, the chief federal prosecutor in any given federal district. I feel like I often put them in sort of two molds. Some of them are aspiring judges, like Justice Alito, who was the U.S. attorney in the district I worked in, New Jersey, or they're aspiring politicians, like the current U.S. attorney there, Chris Christie. People say he may run for governor, and they often will fall into different molds. The political U.S. attorneys tend to be much more sort of glad-handing, baby-kissing, back-slapping. The ones who want to be judges are much more academic and reserved. To be kind of snobby, they tend to have more of a pedigree, like they tend to have gone to places like Chicago for law school. Like, that's sort of that model. But, it's interesting. I feel like when you have an elected judiciary, you place much more of a priority on the backslapping and the baby kissing, whereas when you have a life-tenured appointed judiciary, people are much more focused on seeing what trajectory they've established, like Judge Posner was saying, and then figuring out, okay, this person all their life has walked the straight and narrow path, and they have jumped through every hoop and grabbed every brass ring, and we're hoping then that they won't deviate from that. Now, every now and then, you do have someone who deviates from that path. I mean, that's kind of what I did. But most people, you know, the past is often, you know, there's always that disclaimer with stock and mutual fund ads, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future success. But oftentimes when you're picking federal judges, it is. I mean, I don't think we're going to see, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg photograph, you know, waving her bra around in DuPont Circle. You know, I mean, that's just not who she is. And that's why when things like that do happen, it's so fascinating.
Nothing like that has ever happened.
I don't know about Justice, maybe not with Justice, although, you know, interestingly enough, she was a cheerleader in high school. And actually, you can find pictures on the internet of her. She was actually a very striking and comely young woman, and I think that as she moved through the legal world, perhaps she felt that she had to sort of frump it up or something. I mean, it's sort of like the reverse makeover, you know, like in the romantic comedies, or especially the teen comedies, like whether it's Clueless or She's All That or whatever, you know, there's a character who's kind of dowdy, and then they play like an up-tempo musical montage, and she takes off the glasses, and she dyes her hair, and then she's fabulous. It was almost like the opposite. Like, she was this cheerleader at a school in Brooklyn. She was very popular with the boys. And then suddenly she's like, okay, I got to become a judge. So then she decides that she's going to pull that hair back into that tight little bun and get those huge glasses. And now she looks like Heather Matarazzo from Welcome to the Dollhouse. And, like, so sometimes you wonder. I mean, I'd be curious, actually, whether that was, like, a deliberate evolution. Not that you can't have judges, federal judges, who are stylish, like Judge Wardlaw or Judge Wood or Judge Diane Wood, who I proclaimed a judicial hottie possessing a certain je ne sais quoi. So there are judges out there who can work it in F3rd and on the runway, but, you know, most of them are not really that type.
And on that note...
So as usual, the federal side does not endorse the views. And there is a reception around the corner that I encourage you all to come to, and thank you very much.